Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. We started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. I'm really tickled about this episode of Wheels Off. Alejandro Escovedo has been a hero of mine since I was, 15 years old, and I saw his band, The True Believers, play at the Arcadia Theater in Dallas, Texas. I was in the front row, and I was blown away. I've watched his career evolve. He's tried out all these different things, different bands, just the list of bands that he's been in. Let's see, The Nuns, Rank and File, True Believers, Buick McCain, and then all of his incredible solo albums. He's a really beautiful man with a good heart, and his songwriting is unparalleled. So to get to interview him for Wheels Off and to get to share the interview with you guys, I feel like that's why I'm doing this. And I'm really excited that you guys are going to get to hear this. Please know that there's a little bit of, sound quality issues, I think he was in his manager's office, and a few times it sounds like somebody turns on a vacuum cleaner. And then a couple of times he got excited, I think, and banged on the table. And then maybe the microphone, a gate closed up and then takes a second to reopen. My point is, there will be a couple of moments where you're like, whoa, soap with that. It's worth it. Just hang in there. Trust me. It's all worth it. I think you guys are really going to love this. He's a really special man. Please welcome to Wheels Off the great Alejandro Escovedo. Welcome to Wheels Off, Alejandro Escovedo. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm great, and thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
For the edification of our listeners, where are you logging in from?
Austin, Texas. I'm at my manager's office, Ryan Madison, who I know.
Yeah. It's very cool, man. Congratulations on the new record.
Thank you. I'm happy, man. I really love it. You know as well as I do that I want to love every record I make, I want to love every song I write. That's not always the case. There's some records that I don't even listen to anymore at all. But this one I'm really enjoying. I enjoyed the making of it, the way it came about, where I recorded it in Italy, and all the great food I ate while I was there. And it was just a wonderful experience, And it was really interesting to go back through all of my records and all my songs and pick out what to me was kind of like a retrospective that I curated myself,
How did you make the decisions about which songs would make the cut?
Well, it's funny because I went there with the intention of writing an album, total improvised album, right?
Yeah.
And I went in with very little other than some ideas, very sketchy musical ideas and very sketchy lyrical ideas, And then as I was boarding the plane, I began to listen to a lot of my older songs, just to kind of get inspired in a way. And I thought, it'd be so cool to go back and let's deconstruct all this stuff and see what's down there at the core of all these songs, And so when I got there, I knew that I wanted to do a song called Sensitive Boys.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do a song called Wave of Mine, And I listened to the Calexico version of Wave, which they did for a tribute record when I was ill with Hep C, you know?
Yeah.
And I love their version of it. It's very expansive and broad and just has this beautiful kind of chemistry about it, you know? And then I knew that I wanted to do those two songs. So those were kind of the first two songs we recorded. And now I also knew that I didn't want a drummer. I didn't want a bass player. I thought that the three of us between us had enough musical savvy to create something different and wonderful. And it worked out that, you know, Wave was, I think, the first song we recorded, and it sounded beautiful. And I thought, this is awesome. You know, let's keep going. And then we did Sensitive Boys with just piano as a piano piece, you know. Yeah. And it turned out really, really cool. So, and then following days, I would come down with three songs and I would play them for the, Antonio and Nicola. And then Nicola would start to create a loop, you know, on some sort of gadget that he had or whatever we would do. Sometimes we bang on a guitar to create a loop or a piano keyboard or something. But anyway, we started to create loops. And then we would all make sure that I was comfortable with the tempo of the song. And then we just go in and start cutting it, you know. And a lot of what we did was first take stuff. There's very little overdubbing on that.
That's so cool. In addition to the some more well-known songs, was there anything that you like rescued from the obscurity? Any deep cuts that you pulled out and wanted to, you know, represent to the world?
Well, like Outside Your Door is like it was a True Believers song.
Yeah.
But it was hardly ever played. And, you know, nobody really listened to the True Believers anyway. So
I did.
I know you did. But, you know, it was a very limited audience for the True Believers. So I thought it'd be cool to bring back that song and really kind of give it something a little different. And I even rewrote some of the lyrics on that one, you know, so.
Yeah, why not? It's your song.
Yeah, it was mine to abuse in whatever way I wanted to, you know, so. So, yeah, it was fun to rewrite. And I really had a blast making the record. It's good times.
So that must have been in the can for a little while now. I'm wondering, because I know you're a restless soul, do you have something that you're already working on right now, thinking about, that's lighting you up at the moment?
Well, as a result of going to Italy, we recorded 18 songs while we were there. Four of them have been withheld to go back and finish a covers record done in basically the same way. And so I did... Alexandra Leaving by Leonard Cohen. I did On the Nickel by Tom Waits. I did another Scarlet Butterfly by Kevin Kenny, which is going to be on the Kevin Kenny tribute record, you know. And then I did a song called Lazy, which was a nun song, actually. And when the nuns used to play, Jennifer Moreau, who was our keyboard, she was gorgeous, very Nico-esque looking young lady. And she would come up by herself, very elegant, sit at the piano and play this song, Lazy, you know. And it was just like, I'm too lazy to fall in love, you know, kind of vibe, very kind of Marlene Dietrich kind of vibe. And then the nuns would come out looking like, you know, drug pushers or whatever we were at the time, gangsters of some kind. And then, you know, so the contrast was really kind of fun. But I wanted to do that song as a tribute to Jennifer and as a tribute to the nuns, you know, because once again, another band that no one ever really heard, but I love being in. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been lucky enough to get to see you all, you know, over all these years and all the different projects you've been a part of and, you know, loved all of them. I wonder when it started for you. Do you remember a moment when you knew this was going to be your life? Do you remember like an epiphany moment as a kid where you knew it was going to be music or rock and roll? Or was it like pre, was it before you ever became conscious that you were already doomed?
Well, you know, unlike a lot of kids, I did not play guitar. I wasn't like in a band in high school or junior high or whatever. I was a surfer, you know, and so I surfed all the time and I dedicated my life to surfing. But I bought a lot of records. I come from a musical family, so there was always music around, right? And there was always an acoustic guitar around, you know, that I would learn a couple chords on and play, but I was never serious about it. So when I got in the Nuns, I was already like 23 years old, you know? And the Nuns were really just, you know, we were trying to make a movie about the worst band in the world. And since we couldn't play, we thought we looked so cool, you know, that we would be the members of the band. So we ditched the movie, became a band. Fortunately, punk rock embraced us, you know, and that became like one of the bigger bands in San Francisco at the time, you know. And from there, I moved to New York City with the Nuns, and we lived at the Chelsea Hotel, you know, because the last show I played in San Francisco with the Nuns was opening up for the Sex Pistols, right?
God.
So then we moved to the Chelsea, and I lived in the Chelsea and encountered, you know, Sid and Nancy were our neighbors, right? You know, so I was playing with this wonderful artist by the name of Judy Nylon at the time. And I met Judy because I loved this band. Well, first of all, I used to see her name on all the Brian Eno, John Cale records, singing backup and so. And that song, Judy's Jungle, I think it's on Taken Tiger Mountain, is about Judy Nylon, you know. And so she kind of came and said, you're going to be in my band. So I was in her band, and there was so many great players in that band, you know, members of the Bush Tetras and you know, just different New Yorkers that were there at the time. And so I was in that band. And then at that point, I started to feel like something had to happen or else I wasn't going to continue in music, you know. And Chip and the Dills broke up. So Chip came out, we formed Rank and File. And we started out in New York City. We booked a tour that left on the night that Ronald Reagan was elected president. We left from New York City. We had 7 shows in 7 weeks. And it took us from New York City all the way to Vancouver, BC, you know. And along the way, we found Austin, Texas, you know. We played at Raul's, you know, just before it closed, you know. So this is like 1980, I guess, you know. And we then made our way all the way, you know, San Francisco, when Rank and File first played in San Francisco, people hated us. They were pelting us with beer cans and you know, Jello was there, Jello Biafra, and he's going, why is everybody so happy? You know, like everybody, you know, that kind of vibe. We had turned our backs in their eyes. We had turned our backs on punk rock, you know, by playing. We weren't even a country band. It was quite a stretch to say we were a country band, but we loved country music and we loved kind of mixing it up, you know? And so after that tour, we went back to New York City. Two of the guys in the band split. They broke, you know, the band broke up basically on the way home. And then we decided that if we were going to pursue this, you know, kind of marriage of country music and punk rock music, this wasn't the place to be. New York City was not the place to be. So we moved to Austin, and that was like 1981, you know, we moved. And it was then, I think, when my daughter Maya was born. And at this point, I still haven't written any songs really, you know. but I'm surrounded by probably some of the greatest songwriters in the world, you know, Towns and Joe Ely and Jimmy Dale and Butch and, you know, Jubal Clark and Lucinda Williams and Pat Mears. And it just goes on and on. It was amazing. So for me, it was quite an education. And I didn't write my first song until I was in the True Believers. And it was a song called "The Rain Won't Help You When It's Over," you know. And at that point, when my daughter was born, I realized that I either had to get serious about music or I had to get serious about something. I was working in the library at the university, you know, and I thought maybe this is, you know, I've always loved to be around books and maybe this is my gig, you know. But I went on and we started the True Believers, and that kind of like, you know, really kind of got me to be a songwriter, you know. I think prior to that, all I wanted was just to be a guitar player in a band, to look cool, have cool pants, cool hair, you know, and have a cool guitar and just be that guy, you know. And then once I started writing songs, though, it was like an avalanche, you know. They really like, you know, I'm sure you've had those moments in your life where as a songwriter, it's like every time you pick up the guitar, there's a song waiting for you, you know. Yeah. And it's a magical time. Unfortunately, I was also drinking way too much at the time. So a lot of that stuff is in the cosmos, you know, but a lot of it is not, you know. A lot of it made its way onto my first album, Gravity, you know.
I wonder about that time, late 70s, early 80s. It seemed like people that were trying, like you decided when Maya was born and you decided you were going to take it seriously. You started really trying. You were going to write songs and take it seriously. And it seemed like at that time, it was almost really uncool to try.
Right. I had no choice but to try, right? I had to try harder than most, probably, because of my willingness to be just the guitar player in the band, people assumed that that's all I was, you know?
Yeah.
And I know that when I first started writing songs and bringing them to the forefront, like, you know, I have this song that I love called Five Hearts Breaking, you know? And when I took it to the True Believers, they didn't like it at all. It wasn't rock and roll enough for the True Believers, you know? It was a little too sensitive. It was a little too narrative, I guess, you know? So they didn't like it. And my brother especially despised it. So, you know, there was that struggle, you know? And you know this, that it's not easy to come out and say, this is how I feel, this is how I think, this is how this has affected me as a result. This is a song that I've written about that experience, you know. And I wasn't writing, you know, the songs were kind of serious in nature, I guess, because of everything that had happened, you know. And so I wasn't a teenager, you know, and I'd never had those kind of like pop star dreams, you know. I never really had those, you know. And I think it's because I started later, you know, to do it.
To hear you describe your geographical movements and then the choices that you made early in the career and then the stuff that I've watched over the years that you do, it feels like there's this through line of bravery. Like does it feel to you like what you're doing is brave, or does it just feel like this is what you have to do?
I've never thought of you know, first of all, I try not to think of myself too much. You know, I try to avoid that kind of thought. So I don't sit there and think like, what is my role here? You know, why, you know, I just do it. Right. And I found that for me to get good results, that's to be, you know, kind of blind to all the other stuff, but just to focus on how do I get that cello to sound like a, you know, 10 guitars coming through a Marshall or something, you know? So it's, I've always been more involved in that. And I think that's why a lot of this sometimes comes as a big surprise to me. It's almost like, wow, I made a record and I got to record with Tony Visconti and, you know, but it comes later, you know what I mean? It, like at the time, I'm just so into the project and into what we're doing that I don't think of the historical significance of all that stuff.
So maybe that is part of the answer to the next question, but I wonder about when you encounter self-generated obstacles, like stuff in your head that's keeping you from being the artist you should be or could be, making the best art you could make. When you come up against that stuff, what have you figured out in terms of a strategy for getting beyond that, those obstacles?
You know, it's still really hard for me, man. It's not easy. I mean, I can beat myself up to the point of being somewhat paralyzed creatively sometimes, you know. I'm not the guy that gets up every day, goes to work to write a song. I'm not that kind of writer. And I admire writers that can do that, you know. My brother was very much like that. He had a lot of songs, you know. My songs, I tend to be more, I don't know, you know, like now it's all about what do I want to say? What do I have left to say? You know, what do I want to, and a lot of that legacy is really kind of all about like, what is the conversation I want to have with my children and my grandchildren, you know, when I'm no longer here. So it's the stories to tell are about their grandparents and how they got from Mexico to America, what America was when I was growing up, what America is now in comparison. What were those records that I listened to that, you know, used to turn me on to the point that I was willing to walk around in a green velvet suit and high heel boots and a crazy haircut, you know, in Huntington Beach where nobody else, you know, it was, I could have been killed actually, you know, doing that. But, you know, what was it that drove me? You know, why was Bowie so important to me? You know, why was Lou Reed so important? So all that kind of stuff is kind of stuff that I think about. And how do I leave that to my kids, you know, really?
So it's funny. So you described not wanting to, or intentionally not thinking about the bigger picture or your place in the bigger picture. But in a way, you're sort of doing a first person version of that, where you're always aware of the story that you're, not the story that you're in, but your own narrative. Does that make sense? Are you trying
to try? Yeah, I mean, the narrative is a big deal for me. I mean, I think that telling stories has always been part of how I write, you know? And I grew up with a father who was a great storyteller. And love to just, you know, I told someone the other day, it was like, you know, that movie, The Big Fish, you know, and it was like, you know, the stories took on different characters and they would evolve in different ways. And, you know, he would forget parts sometimes. So he would make up another part, you know, so he was great like that, you know? And so I guess I'm part of that tradition in my family. Yeah.
Man. That's really beautiful. Well, I know that this is the kind of question that you think about. So just from hearing you talk about kids and grandkids and the narrative, if you were to try and distill some of this wisdom that you're sharing with us, that you share with them, imagine a 21-year-old version of Alejandro in today's in today's world. Yeah. What advice do you think you would give that younger version of yourself?
I think that I would tell that younger version to be a little more focused on what it was that I loved at the time and to be more informed about what's going to happen in the future in a way and how we can stand up for what we believe in, stand strongly in what we believe in, and to never waver from that, to never allow anyone to tell you that you're less than what you are and can be. And that even though we're told that there's this great big open world out there, there are a lot of pitfalls to the belief in that system. And I believe that education for me was pretty much non-existent, in that they tried to create a world in which to live in that did not exist for us, you know. And I'm talking about the Mexican-American experience, you know, where we were told we could be whatever we wanted to be, but weren't necessarily allowed to be that person. Yeah. And that's the greatest injustice in my view. Yeah.
Is your sense that that has evolved at all, or is it still?
No, it has not. It hasn't. It's gotten worse. And it's gotten worse because now you have people who have a national forum, international forum, to express these racist and divisive ideas about who we are. You know, I'm still stunned that some of my friends will say, I'll say, you know, like, who is it? You know, who who is she married to? I hear she's got, she's Vietnamese, but she married an American, right? And so by American, what they mean is a white guy, you know? And so what is being an American, you know? So we find ourselves, you know, losing faith in that concept of America. Mm. And hoping that my children and grandchildren and your children and your grandchildren don't have to, you know, resort to violence or whatever it takes to steer the ship in another direction.
I feel hopeful. Is that crazy? Do you think that's
no, it's not okay. Crazy. Okay. You know, but it is the opium of the masses.
Oh, Alejandro, man, you are so great. I'm so glad you agreed to talk to me. And I feel like people are going to love this. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom. And I'm so excited for the new record. Congratulations.
Well, thanks, Red. It's always a pleasure hanging out. So we need to do it sometime when we're not doing this and just share a beer or something somewhere. You know?
I love it.
All right, man.
Take care.
Take care of yourself.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris.
Hello out there.
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!